I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. The Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act was signed by President Obama in 2010. Supporters said it would toughen regulatory oversight of the country's banking system and prevent the risky behavior that led to the financial collapse that led to the recession. So is the financial system any safer than it was before Dodd-Frank? A recent Senate subcommittee investigation of J.P. Morgan Chase's trading fiasco has raised some troubling questions about banking behavior. We asked Jesse Eisinger to join us on Radio Times. He's a senior reporter at ProPublica covering Wall Street and finance. He also writes a regular column for the New York Times Deal Book section. And back in 2011, he and Jake Bernstein received the Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting for a series of stories they did on questionable Wall Street practices. And Jesse Eisinger, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for having me back, Marty.
You're welcome. And speaking of those questionable practices and speaking more broadly about the financial industry overall, is it any more reformed than it was several years ago?
I don't think it's substantially more reformed. Obviously, there's been some tinkering around the edges. But if you look broadly, what you have is a bunch of giant banks. They're even bigger than before. They're not substantially more transparent in their activities. And their motivations are to maximize their own personal income while taxpayers are on the hook still for their collapse, which provides terrible incentives. So broadly speaking, I don't think we have really altered the structure either of the banking system in this country or the regulatory system. It doesn't strike me that we're substantially better off.
Does that mean that Dodd-Frank is toothless? I know it's still being written, but that it really doesn't have the kind of clout to regulate these banks?
You know, Dodd-Frank, as you say, is a work in progress, but that's part of the problem. It's a work in progress that's been going on for over 2 years now after the bill has been signed. The regulators are still wrangling with the major provisions of how to regulate derivatives, how to figure out whether we can unwind banks in the event of their failure without putting taxpayer money at substantial risk. Figuring out what kinds of activities the banks should be permitted to engage in or be banned from engaging in, such as making bets with their own for their own profits using taxpayer-backed money. None of that is finalized. So I think you could very easily say that Dodd-Frank is a failure today. In fact, former SEC Commissioner Arthur Levitt told me that. We quoted him in an article about that a couple of years ago, and I don't think things have gotten better.
Well, we talk about too big to fail. Are we talking about too complex to regulate?
Yes, exactly. In fact, too big to fail is a wonderful phrase, but a misnomer. What we're really talking about is too important to fail, too interconnected to fail. It doesn't really have to do with size, although size matters, as the old phrase goes.
Yes.
The issue here is that, you know, you have banks which occupy a special place in our economy, and if they're too important, the government is going to bail them out. The government is going to have to come in and save them to preserve the banking system in some fashion because it's too important for the economy. So what we need to do is figure out how to do that, putting the bankers' money and shareholders' money and creditors' money at risk so that they take prudent risks while minimizing the amount of money that taxpayers are on the hook for.
Attorney General Eric Holder testified recently, and the takeaway was that he was saying that these banks are too big to prosecute. Is that what you think he was saying?
Well, it's interesting what he was trying to say. I think he was essentially suggesting that. Now, there are competing interpretations of what he was saying. Since for about a decade, since Arthur Andersen, especially the accounting firm, the prosecutors have been highly reluctant to prosecute certain kinds of companies. Now, what happened with Arthur Andersen, the accounting firm, is that in the wake of Enron, the accounting firm itself was prosecuted and put out of business because of that prosecution, leaving us with four major accounting firms instead of five. And then that was subsequently overturned by the Supreme Court. Now, prosecutors have learned the lesson, drawn the lesson. I'm not sure this is necessarily a lesson to have drawn, but they have drawn the lesson that this was the wrong thing to do. This is a terrible mistake because it put a lot of innocent people out of work. And so they are highly sensitive now to the idea of prosecuting a company in such a way that it would put the company out of business and then throw a lot of innocent workers on the street.
Let's talk about this J.P. Morgan Chase, I guess, hearing. This was Senator Carl Levin, head of the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, looking into J.P. Morgan Chase, looking into the London office, something that's referred to as the London Whale. You have referred to it. Other people have as well. What does that mean, the London Whale?
Well, what happened was starting in 2011 and going into 2012, the London office of J.P. Morgan's, a part of the office called the Chief Investment Office that was supposed to essentially manage the risks, part of the risks of the bank in a kind of prudent way, in a careful way, not to take too many investment risks with that money. In fact, this London office was swinging for the fences. Mm-hmm. They were becoming a profit center. And one trader in particular was taking very outsized bets in a complex index of derivatives, which are sort of complex financial instruments that are side bets on underlying securities. And so this ostensibly started as a hedge to protect the bank from its exposures lending to companies. But in fact, this really was speculation.
Wow.
And he became so big that he became dubbed in the press and in the market as the London Whale. He was such a big figure in this particular index. And then it ended disastrously, where hedge funds and other investors figured out that he was overly exposed, that he was essentially trying to corner a market in this little piece of the index, and he couldn't really do it, and they ganged up on the other side and caused J.P. Morgan to lose an enormous amount of money.
In fact, they lost, what, something like $6 billion?
Yes, it escalated from the initial estimates and now stands a little bit over $6 billion. I think that's the total. Of course, there may be more to come. It's possible.
Now, Jamie Dimon, how does he fare in this London Whale saga?
Well, he comes out pretty disastrously. Jamie Dimon emerged as one of the best, most well-respected bankers after the financial crisis because he steered his bank, J.P. Morgan Chase, through the financial crisis with relatively little harm. Other banks took more money from the government, were on the brink of failure. J.P. Morgan, of course, did take money from taxpayers, but purported to say that they didn't need it. And Jamie Dimon became the last man standing among the bankers. So he was regarded as the best CEO, and the J.P. Morgan was regarded as having the best risk management. This completely destroyed that idea that J.P. Morgan had great risk management. In fact, J.P. Morgan didn't have good enough risk management to avoid this kind of very basic rudimentary problem, which is a trader and his immediate bosses and their boss from taking outsized risks that they didn't fully understand. So what's happened here is that no one really understood what kind of exposure J.P. Morgan had, and yet they were still ignoring red flags and putting on bigger and bigger bets, the exact kind of thing that we don't want banks to do, especially when they're backed explicitly and implicitly with taxpayer money.
Well, and Jamie Dimon originally referring to this as a tempest in a teapot.
Right, it's a shameful episode where he tried to play the importance down, and on that very same call, as was revealed by the Permanent Subcommittee's investigation, the CFO made a bunch of highly misleading statements to the shareholders and the public. Now, whether those statements actually constitute lies or violations of securities laws, that's unclear. Maybe that will be investigated, maybe not, unfortunately, but certainly they were were highly misleading. And this Tempest and the Teapot, Jamie Dimon has referred to as a mistake, as a kind of stupid comment, but it shows their underlying cavalier attitude about this stuff.
You know, I have to say, talking to you about this particular bank and this particular fiasco, if we can say that, I mean, this just reminds me of conversations we had 4 and 5 years ago, you and I, and talking with other people about risky behavior and CEOs that don't exactly know what's going on and misinformation to shareholders and then losses of billions of dollars.
Well, I think that's exactly it, and that's what's so shocking about it. So what we have here is a bank that took enormous risks. It took enormous risks that it didn't understand, and the regulators both did not understand what it was doing and ignored it and really sort of let them off the hook for it looked the other way. So we have an exact replay of all the problems of the financial crisis. And so what I was trying to make a point of in my recent column was that even if you've had some tinkering around the structure of the financial regulatory system, so now derivatives are technically regulated instead of not being regulated, that's good. But what we haven't had is any cultural change in banking or in regulation. The cultural change in banking has not been to say we need to take extremely prudent risks. Obviously, we have to take some risk because we need to make money, but we don't want to be swinging for the fences in opaque ways and complex derivative products that we can't really adequately risk manage. And the regulators should be saying we need transparency from the organizations that we regulate, and if they lie to us, if they mislead us, there are going to be serious consequences. We got none of that in the London Whale. We had to wait for Senator Levin's report before we got any kind of accounting of what happened here because the regulators were asleep at the switch. So we have had no change in the fundamental culture of the way we operate our banking system and regulate it.
And that's Jesse Eisinger. Jesse, we have to take a break in about 45 seconds here, but just quoting you, you say, all the while the regulator served as its typical role of house pet. Is that how you see regulators, as house pets?
Yes, I do. I think we have a captured regulatory system and a broken regulatory system, and we need a wholesale cultural change in it. It's not a matter of changing the rules. We need to change their attitudes about it.
Well, let's take that very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Jesse Eisinger today on Radio Times. He's a senior reporter at ProPublica. He covers Wall Street and finance. He also writes a regular column for the New York Times Deal Book section, and as I said, won a Pulitzer Prize, co-won a Pulitzer Prize 2 years ago on some of his reporting on questionable Wall Street practices. And we're talking about how the financial system is behaving today, what the regulators are and aren't doing, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Much more to talk about after this short break. We'll be right back.
The Chester County Historical Society supports WHYY and presents the 31st Annual Chester County Antiques Show, Friday, April 5th through Sunday, April 7th at the Phelps School in Malvern, PA. More than 50 exhibitors feature 18th and 19th century American and continental furniture, rugs, paintings, glass, silver, jewelry, needlework, and other decorative arts. Presented by PICO. For details on tickets, show hours, and sponsorship opportunities, 610-692-4800 or chestercohistorical.org.
Racial and ethnic minorities are becoming the majority in this country sooner than expected, and for many people, this rapid change will be a challenge.
There's going to be a real challenge to educate those older folks that these people are really important.
We'll talk about that next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Speaker Series, presented by Widener University, announces its 2013-14 season at the Kimmel Center. Seven engaging evenings with Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak, author Bill Bryson, former Greek Prime Minister George Papandreou, former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, poet laureate Billy Collins, ambassador John Huntsman, and historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. PhiladelphiaSpeakerSeries.org. Sponsored by WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Jesse Eisinger about our financial system, whether it's safer, more stable, more transparent, post-Dodd-Frank. And we've been talking about a Senate subcommittee hearing on J.P. Morgan Chase's London whale trade fiasco, raising concerns about whether risky practices are still rampant in the financial industry. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Jesse, just picking up on what you just said about the regulators using, I guess, this J.P. Morgan Chase fiasco and even Senator Levin's investigation, what do you think they should do next, even if they're not capable of doing it yet?
Specifically about the whale or just in general?
Well, let's start with the whale and then we'll talk about it in general. Go ahead.
All right. Well, in the whale, it seems like there were a couple of things. J.P. Morgan stopped giving them certain reports, the reports of how much the certain offices were making, and there seems to have been no real reaction from the OCC, which is the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, which is the J.P. Morgan's main regulator. And then they kind of did it arbitrarily. Obviously, that can't happen. You can't have a bank arbitrarily decide what kind of reports it's going to be sending its regulator and whether it's going to be sending them at all. And then the report makes it pretty clear that the OCC was misled or was told inaccurate information, was told that the position was decreasing when it was increasing, was told that the losses were less than they were. Some of this could be a miscommunication. Some of this could have been misinterpretation from what the OCC thought incorrectly. But if there should be a thorough investigation, and if they were misled, there has to be consequences. You know, something has to happen to J.P. Morgan if, in fact, it was misleading. Even inadvertently misleading, I think there needs to be consequences for that. Overall, it seems to me like regulators need to have a much more skeptical attitude about what the banks are telling them and why, demanding more information, more timely information, accurate information, and expecting that those banks are going to be offering information that's not accurate simply because it's not in their interest to do it, or they're congenitally unable to do it, which is sort of a natural consequence. You don't want to you don't tell your parents everything. And so you have to have an attitude that these guys are going to be misleading, and they don't.
But would it be fair to say that if these risky practices, behaviors were happening at J.P. Morgan Chase, it's probably happening in other parts of the financial industry?
I mean, I certainly think that. If J.P. Morgan, which had the best reputation before this and was regarded as the best managed bank with best risk management, was capable of this kind of loss. And let's be clear, the loss was $6 billion, but that's just a matter of coincidence and luck. It could be $60 billion very easily. You know, J.P. Morgan has literally over $70 trillion worth of derivatives exposure, and if it made a little bit of a mistake, 0.01% mistake on that, that's billions and billions of losses. So other banks have this, and I have no confidence that other banks are substantially better managed than J.P. Morgan. In fact, I think that they're probably worse managed, and their financials are equally opaque and complex. And this means that no one can really understand them, from their investors to the regulators to accounting specialists to the managers themselves. And it's simply untenable to have opaque, giant institutions that cannot be managed, that are so vital to our economy and our economic well-being. It's a terrible situation where we have ticking time bombs.
Let me get a caller, and then I do want to ask you a question about the SEC. Then we're going to have to say goodbye to you. But let's see what Michael from Chester Springs has to say. Michael, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I I think you might have at least partially already answered my question. My question was, why are we in a situation where these guys make mistakes and we pick up the tab? There doesn't seem to be any penalty at all. If the bets pay off, they reap all the rewards and nobody says anything. And if they don't, we pay for the losses. Nobody goes to jail.
Michael,
putting our entire economy at risk. And I don't know if, you know, it's the SEC or individual shareholders or some other organization that ought to be suing these people and looking for some sort of redress, but it strikes me as kind of crazy.
Well, Michael, let me see what I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me see what Jesse Eisinger says. Jesse?
Well, the caller is exactly right. So it's a very bad situation. Now, the banking system is so important that if it fails, taxpayers are going to have to bail it out in some fashion. So what we want to do is have institutions that could fail that didn't take down all the other institutions, which would mean that we would have at least either smaller institutions or simpler institutions. If you break the banks up, they're by definition smaller problems. And so that would make it less likely that taxpayers would have to come in and bail them out. And the second aspect of that is there have to be serious consequences for wrongdoing. Now, you know, there is stupidity and recklessness. That's not necessarily criminal, but there should be some kinds of consequences for that. They should lose money, and taxpayers shouldn't necessarily be on the hook. But then if there is wrongdoing, if there's lying, if there's securities fraud, then they have to be able to, prosecutors have to be able to prosecute these people. And somehow, for some reason, complex reasons, prosecutors haven't been able to bring any cases in the wake of the financial crisis against any senior bank executives and financial firm executives. And that has led to all sorts of malign consequences. It's leading to moral hazard, I believe.
Michael, thanks for the call. Jesse, let me just quote something that you wrote in February, actually, about Mary Jo White. This is President Obama's nomination to head up the Securities and Exchange Commission. You say now Ms. White maintains she can run the SEC without fear or favor. She has worked for the banking industry, but the focus shouldn't be limited to whether she can be effective. For lobbyists, the real targets are regulators and staff members for lawmakers. You're saying the real jockeying or influence is what lobbyists are doing to sort of lower level people within government?
Yes. So that's all out of the public eye. These are incredibly complex issues. There's billions and billions of dollars at stake, but the public has no understanding of this. And so that's where lobbyists really work their magic with staffers. Staffers at the regulators and staffers at in Congress. And so, you know, they put enormous resources into that. They have extreme, this is not just in the financial world, but the financial world is the one that's arguably one of the most important. But the very nature of our Congress is set up so that special interests have extreme attention paid to very specific issues, while the public only has a general gloss on that, which makes what I was writing about, the revolving door, all the more pernicious, where you have people going from the OCC to a shadow regulatory body that's a private company that advises banks called Promontory, and then back to the OCC. You have tax specialists from the Senate go to GE and then go back to work for the Senate. This is all the kind of revolving door where special interests can exercise their influence and the public has no understanding of it.
Well, on that note, my thanks as always, Jesse Eisinger, for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And he's a senior reporter at ProPublica covering Wall Street and finance, writes a regular column for the New York Times deal section, a deal book section, I should say. And back in 2011, he and Jake Bernstein won a Pulitzer Prize for their national reporting on Wall Street's questionable practices. Well, we all know the Hans Christian Andersen story, The Emperor's New Clothes. Our guest, Anat Admati, is co-author of a new book titled The Banker's New Clothes, What's Wrong with Banking and What to Do About It. She and her co-author, Martin Helwig, said they want to demystify banking for the public. They also say the system would be safer and more stable if banks had more capital and less debt. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times. I know you were listening in as I was talking with Jesse Eisinger.
Yes. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Anything you want to say in response to what Jesse Eisinger was saying, looking at the banking industry and whether it really has, reformed itself and is taking steps to be more stable and secure and more transparent? Do you see any evidence of that?
Well, I share Jesse's concerns quite clearly, and I've seen them firsthand, even though I come at it completely from a different place. I come from academia, and I was sheltered from all this real-life, down-in-the-ground issues. But the more I look, the more concerned I am about how much has changed, and indeed about whether the regulators and even politicians are really remembering what they're supposed to be doing.
The title of your book, of course, a riff on the king or the emperor having no clothes. Essentially, you're saying we're all acting as if the emperor is clothed when he really is naked, that we should think that way about the banking system as well?
Well, it says the banker's no clothes, but it's really about a lot of things that a lot of people say about banking. There is a mystique about banking that pervades the regulators, even the academics. Somehow they're being treated as so different and so special, and that allows them to get away with really dangerous practices, and it allows the regulations to settle in a completely wrong place from the public's perspective, completely and based on flawed arguments bordering from nonsense to more subtle ones, a whole wardrobe of flawed clothes. And so it's banking experts, it's bankers, it's lots of people who say all kinds of things, and we try to sort of unpack all of that in the book.
Well, in fact, and part of what you unpack is that you say that banks rely much too much on debt and not enough on capital. Help us what you mean by that.
Yes, well, it's easy to explain once you kind of place it in the right context. Banks are incredibly heavy borrowers.
Borrowers, yes.
They borrow, first of all, from all of us. In fact, I can make the point quite easily with an item very hot in the news, Cyprus.
Yes.
So look at the Cyprus banks. They borrowed, you can say, from all the Cyprus citizens who trust their money with the banks. And, of course, they nominally borrowed from all these Russian oligarchs as well, promising everybody 4-5% interest. Actually, they promised incredibly high interest rates. Now, in the market, you might think something is great, but a lot of things are too good to be true. To get 4-5% with no risk, that's not possible at today's interest rates. So what do? They go in and lend the money to Greece, to Greek government. Well, the Greek government is promising 15% or more, promising, but not always delivering because Greece is in big trouble. So sure enough, banks in Cyprus take depositors' money, pretty much almost entirely depositors' money, promising a higher return above what German banks are promising, for example, and then going investing it at risky lending, essentially. You could think that somebody lends to homeowners who can't pay or to a government that can't pay. And then, lo and behold, they can't pay back their debts to the depositors because they don't have any way to absorb those losses. So just like a homeowner that buys a house with very little equity and goes underwater when the house price goes down, a corporation doesn't need to borrow very much, and banks don't need to borrow very much. They can use equity funding, just like Apple and every other company, even without regulation, uses, and then they will be able to absorb more losses, and they will be able to, on their own, pay back their depositors and other people that they promised money to. Instead, the regulation allows them to essentially use borrowed money, take the upside, which is highly magnified, and put the downside on other people.
But are you saying that American banks behave like the banks in Cyprus or the banks in Greece, that they are essentially operating under the same practices?
Well, these regulations are very flawed, and even the American bankers do a lot of tricks, and increasingly more so. They were not allowed to, and part of what saved us were people like Sheila Bair, who did not allow some of these regulations that were so flawed to take hold in this country. But the SEC, which regulated the investment banks, allowed them to really become so highly indebted. And the tricks that they were using to essentially be able to borrow more involved, for example, claiming, you know, and the regulation allowed it, to claim that something that's rated AAA is essentially as good as cash. Mm. Of course, they would lose on these things, but then they had no ability to absorb those losses. In Europe, the problem is that they treat sovereign debt within Europe, debts of governments within Europe, the Eurozone, as if it's riskless. That's how Cyprus banks could do this. Now, in the U.S., some of the same regulations allow them to potentially over-invest in municipalities and, you know, over-lend in some cases and take risks, but not have enough capacity to bear those losses, but they love the returns that come in. So the regulation treats some investments as less risky than they actually are. So that's part of the flaw. But in general, they really do allow them to live on the edge way too much, to borrow way more than they need to, and they love it. Some of the borrowing is from deposits, which is okay, which is insured. But as a result of that, none of their creditors behave like normal creditors and care about their risk. And instead, the regulators need to do that, and they don't.
Well, one of the things that you and your co-author say in this book is that this amount of debt that the banks use magnifies both good performance and also magnifies both bad performance as well. Help us understand how that works, why that's the result.
Well, what happens is, so imagine that you could put a dollar of your own money and then borrow, you know, $1 billion. And put this in something, and you borrow the $1 billion, but promising to pay, you know, 1%. Then you go invest it in something that pays almost all the time, you know, 3%. On average, it pays a lot more than the rate that you borrowed. You pocket, after you pay your debt, you pocket all the upside. On your $1 of investment, you've made thousands and thousands of percents. It got magnified on the upside, because once you pay your debt, If you make more than your borrowing cost, you get a lot percentage-wise on your dollar, because you have that's an effect of leverage, what's called leverage. Now, on the downside, if you put in a dollar and you don't make what your borrowing rate is, if you make just a little bit below, you're wiped out immediately. So that's the magnification of the downside when you borrow, and when people buy houses with mostly borrowed money. If the house goes down a little bit, their equity gets wiped out. That's the experience. Now, when that happens to a bank, an individual borrower might not be able to buy a house except with borrowed money. And, of course, the bigger the house they buy with very little down payment, the more at risk they are on the downside. And, of course, they do great on the upside if the house price goes up, because they pocket the entire upside. But
well, you know what? I got to jump in here only because we're up on a break, and that's that's okay. We'll be right back. That's Anat Admati. She's the George C. Parker Professor of Finance and Economics at Stanford's Graduate School of Business, co-author of a new book called The Banker's New Clothes. We'll be right back.
The part-time professional MBA at Temple University's Fox School of Business is proud to support WHYY. With evening and weekend classes offered at convenient locations, including Center City, you can complete your MBA in just 20 months. Scholarships are available for qualified candidates. The Fox Part-Time Professional MBA. Discover the power of Fox. Information available at fox.temple.edu/PMBA. Temple University's Fox School of Business.
After England and France went to war with Germany in 1939, there was a ferocious debate in America over whether the U.S. should come to their aid or go even further and enter the war. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the isolationists and interventionists with Lynn Olson, author of Those Angry Days, Roosevelt, Lindbergh, and America's Fight Over World War II. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Research has shown that too much technology can turn kids into zombies, but what about new interactive technology? Toddlers love tablets. One researcher calls iPads a baby rattle on steroids. Also, Detroit's new emergency financial manager, Kevin Orr. What can he do? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY. In Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Anat Admati. She's co-author with Martin Helwig of a new book called The Banker's New Clothes, What's Wrong with Banking and What to Do About It. She serves on the FDIC Systemic Resolution Advisory Committee, and she's a professor of finance and economics at Stanford's Graduate School of Business. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHY. Why? Let me go back to the 19th century, because you write in this book that back in the 19th century, banks were funded themselves with something like 40 to 50% capital. And today, of course, it's very different from that. What explains, I guess, the changes over the years so that banks so much more rely on debt and not capital?
Well, in the 19th century, in the time of the 40 to 50%, banks were private partnerships. Actually, in much of this time, before they became corporations, where the shareholders can, you know, walk away from the debt and can't lose more than what they put in, they were unlimited liability partnerships. So the owners were liable for the deposits with their own assets. So if they lost money, they would have to actually pay it out of whatever else they had. Mm-hmm. And over the years, what happened was, there was less and less actually liability, you could say, in the bank. And equity is really liability. So it became more and more possible for banks, and also more attractive for banks, to just use borrowed money all the time, because more and more, and this explains the trend quite a bit, we put in essentially guarantees and safety nets in the form of deposit insurance, in the form of all sorts of liquidity supports from the central bank, and now implicit too-big-to-fail guarantees. So they were able, people were willing to lend to the banks more easily than they would lend to a similar corporation that doesn't have all these guarantees and safety nets. And we put the guarantees in order to make the system safe, but paradoxically, we then encourage the banks to do these risky things, which is to overborrow.
And knowing that they would get bailed out in one way or another. You and your co-author talk about banks having something like 20 to 30% of their assets in equities. You think that that's a much more balanced system?
That is a much better system. Look, the banks themselves and everybody else in the economy, without any regulation, nobody comes near the indebtedness of the banks. It's just not a healthy place to be. It's not a borrower that's such a heavy borrower as a corporation or even as an individual often becomes essentially addicted to this borrowing. And that's another effect that we discuss in the book, is sort of that overhang effect. You don't want to sort of prepay your debt. You don't want to reduce your indebtedness, but you might increase your indebtedness. For individual borrowers, it's different. For corporations, it's very easy to get in that position. And for banks, the safety net feeds it. So definitely 20 to 30% would just be more normalized for a corporation that has access. They can retain their profits. That's how most corporations do it. And they can get to a safer range without any bad impact on everybody but those that love to live on the edge like this and benefit from the upside, which is mostly the managers of the banks, actually.
Well, that's interesting. But do you think, I mean, looking broadly at corporations, are you suggesting that banks should behave more like corporations? We know that corporations borrow money, they use debt, but perhaps don't use it quite as recklessly or quite as much?
Yes, banks should be more normal. They are corporations for the most part. Most of them are corporations. And they can behave like corporations, they just don't want to. As Martin Wolf said in the review of the book last week, banks, and what we say in the book, of course, is banks are not different except for what they get away with.
And they get away, I mean, and this takes us back to the conversation I was having with Jesse Eisinger about, whether Dodd-Frank has reformed the banks and whether this issue of too big to fail is still with us, and whether that then forces the public to be bailing out banks, and whether that does encourage the kind of risky behavior that we had a couple of years ago that took down the economy.
Definitely we haven't ended too big to fail. The problem with that is the fail part, and it becomes a problem before they fail. When banks get into distress or become insolvent, and they might not even fail, they might be kept alive even when they are zombies, it's possible, because of all the supports they get, they just muddle along, then the economy suffers. Right. We suffer collateral damage from their failure, even from their distress, because they stop lending. So all the credit crunches, which they blame on regulation, are really because they're already behaving distressed, and they're already distorted in their decision. So lending is not attractive for them. Mm-hmm. It's not a problem of money. They go do the derivative trades instead.
Instead of lending?
Yes.
And banks need to lend in order to help the economy grow, yes?
That's right. I mean, one of the main thing we need the banks to do for the economy, because otherwise you could say, you know, any hedge fund can do those derivative trading. Why do it with deposits money? Why do it if, as a bank with a safety net? You know, that was sort of the discussion of Volcker or whatever.
Yes.
But the point is, business lending is kind of not as much fun for the banks. So they don't like to do that. That requires some work on their part, and it's not as easy to scale that up, all these returns. They have to actually work, and it's a good project, but there isn't enough upside for the decision maker. That's because they are heavily indebted. A person doesn't make the investments that benefit creditors or the deposit insurance before they benefit the ones that make the decision. The managers or the shareholders only like enough upside for them. That's a typical behavior of all the highly indebted entity.
You mentioned Volcker. I mean, do you think banks should be separated so that the commercial banks are on one side, the investment banks on another, and different rules apply?
Well, possibly different rules should apply, but we have to remember that investment banks are the ones that got into trouble in the crisis, and being just a bank that takes deposit does not mean necessarily, and we explain this in the book, that you're safe. A lot of banking crisis happened with standard banks. The Spanish banks are in trouble, the Cyprus banks are, and it's not about derivatives there.
Right. It's just about...
We explain, has risks across the board, and separating could make sense, but it's not the answer unless you take care of that collateral damage of distress and failure, which means to have move much more of the downside back where the upside is, more absorption of the losses and more normal funding mix than they have right now.
And that's Anat Admati. She's a professor of finance and economics at Stanford's Graduate School of Business, co-author of a new book that's gotten a fair amount of attention called The Banker's New Clothes, What's Wrong with Banking and What to Do About It. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. One of the things that you write about in this book is that, and I was talking with Jesse Eisinger about just how complex, perhaps even convoluted our banking system is, but the way you write about it, it seems like it's almost on purpose and it's by design to make the system so complex that no one can really regulate it.
Yes. So, in fact, one of the issues really is complexity, because if you think about the failure of a corporation, you know, they go into bankruptcy, you have to unwind or kind of figure out what to do about all these different contracts, who has priority, all of these things that happen in bankruptcy, which are very complicated. Lehman bankruptcy is still going on. And I'm involved in this resolution effort, and they tell you, oh, we solved too big to fail because we have FDIC resolution. Right. It's very complicated because they are so complicated, and they do want it to be like that because they have incentives to get to the point where we're too scared to try to unwind them. And therefore, that gives them that power to just keep making promises that the other side thinks will be taken care of somehow or other.
But do you also think that the Dodd-Frank, which is, of course, an attempt to try to regulate or provide oversight of the banking industry, is also very complex and convoluted, and some people have criticized it as either, if not over-regulation, at least the complexity of regulation?
So one thing to realize is that the Dodd-Frank is a law, not a regulation. So this law, which is very complicated, and I agree, it is really complicated and maybe too complicated. But what, a lot of what it does, so it has many, many, many parts. But a lot of what it does is it gives the regulators authorities in particular ways. And so it allows everything, and sometimes it just recycles authorities that regulators already had, but it expands some of them. So the problem is not as much with Dodd-Frank, it's with the implementation of Dodd-Frank and with the day-to-day actual enforcement of the regulations. So the regulations end up being really weak, and the enforcement of them ends up being really ineffective. And so the banks walk all over the regulators, as Jesse described. They create all these complexities. They don't disclose the information. You know, there's a lot of issues around derivatives and the opacity of those markets. And so you don't get the system to work because it has all the authority. It doesn't have the will to do what it needs to do.
Going back even to the 1990s and to the tech bubble that burst in the 1990s, interestingly, it didn't cause the financial crisis that we saw from the housing bubble. And one of the explanations is that a lot of the tech industry was funded by stocks and not funded by short-term debt. Do you think that explains why it didn't take down the economy the way that the housing bubble did in recent years?
Yeah, so we have a chapter in the book called The Banking Dominoes, and it basically explains why essentially not such a large decline in housing prices in the grand scheme of things, and certainly smaller than the decline in the values of Internet companies back in the sort of burst of the Internet bubble, if you compare that to the sort of burst of the housing bubble, did not cause a worldwide global tsunami that is still lingering, and that's caused so much damage. And that has to do a lot with the indebtedness and the interconnectedness of the players in the system. Mm-hmm. So you have a knotted-up system that does look like sort of a set of dominoes, and we explain all the mechanisms. One of them is through contraction, contractual relation. I fail, and therefore I don't pay you, then you become weaker. Or these rumors, people run because they think something else is not worth as much. Other ways in which the one failure triggers, ripples through the system. And that's partly why it's so important to make the players in this system so much more resilient, and there's just no cost in doing that. It's just reshuffling pieces of paper, and it makes the system so much more stable. It's very frustrating that they're not doing some of the most obvious things and failing to take steps are even simple, and that just instead of repeat the same mistakes they made before.
Well, let me get some callers in. Looks like we have Peter from Lumberton, New Jersey, joining us on Radio Times. And Peter, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you very much.
You're
I'm enjoying the show. Great show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to point out that your guest was doing an excellent job of helping the public understand the disconnect between the official or regulator's perception and the way they deal with the banks and the public perception of it. In drawing the analogy between how we borrow, the average person borrows, and how they deal with the risks and take responsibility when they don't borrow smartly, and how, on the other hand, the banking institution can take cheap money from the Federal Reserve, invest however they feel like, and there is a real high upside to their profits. But yet, when they default or things go bust, the public is held,
holding the bag
accountable. So, unfortunately, you went on a break while she was discussing it, and I don't think everybody got it.
Okay.
So I was hoping that you can go back there. Thank you.
Fair enough. Peter, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Anat Admati, did you understand? Peter, I think, wants to sort of understand that relationship, I guess, or the connection between the public view of banking and how the industry views itself.
Yes. So there is fundamentally in here usually there isn't that conflict, but there is fundamentally, with respect to risk especially, a real conflict of interest between the public and the banks. And the conflict of interest is about safety of the banks. The banks don't choose to be as safe as the public needs them to be. And this is because of a basic, I mean, it starts with a standard borrower-creditor conflict. But what it happens is the creditors feel safe enough, and it becomes a conflict between the borrower, the banks, and the public, who end up bearing the downside. So it basically, the system works and the risk works for primarily, as I said, the managers of the banks. They throw a little something on the upside to the shareholders of the bank, but the shareholders of banks, to the extent they are diversified shareholders like me and you, you know, also suffer otherwise. And then who gets just the downside is, in the end, the taxpayer, which is kind of, you know, most of the other people, with the exception of very few that benefit from this system. So it's really a very, very distorted system.
We have about a minute before I have to say goodbye, but again, quoting from the book, you write, the public has a much greater interest in the bank's safety than do the banks themselves. I guess just underscoring what you just said, but I find that very troubling.
Yes, it is very troubling because it's like speed limits. There is a collateral damage to the risk they take, and lowering that speed doesn't even cost anything from the public's perspective. It would just remove subsidies and correct distortions. But we do need the regulators to take care of that because the public is dispersed and doesn't have the authority to do it.
Do you think there's political will to do what you just said?
Well, we wrote the book because we decided that there isn't enough of a political will and that the only way to change that, or any hope of changing that, before more crisis and more suffering happens, and the distortions, by the way, are every day, not just in a crisis, that the public needs to be aware of because in the election and otherwise, people are a combination of confused, they forget, or whatever, they're told all kinds of things that are scary, and instead they should press on the politicians and on the regulators to protect the public from risk.
Well, Anant Admati, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. She's a professor of finance and economics at Stanford's Graduate School of Business, also co-author of a new book called The Banker's New Clothes, What's Wrong with Banking and What to Do About It. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, but stay with us. We'll be right back. Coming up next.